All right. Welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's a podcast that's hosted by me, Kyle Schoenewill, and my longtime friend, Robbie Earl. Speaking of you being my longtime friend, I was posting a picture of our origin story on Slack. I don't know if you saw that, but
a picture
popped up from 2014, 9 years ago, of the night we won trivia at Mellow Mushroom.
Man.
Why is that important? Because that is often the night I think I am referencing when I talk about the Guardians of the Galaxy trailer being on TV when we were sitting in that corner.
Oh, wow.
You know what I'm talking about? Because it's April 2014. That probably about lines up. I think that's the one.
Oh, you're so right.
At least that window. So man, that's kind of fun.
That is really fun. I spent a while looking at that photo and remembering who all was there for that specific night. That was such a, man, I don't even know Seth, how many times we all did trivia together.
Yeah, yeah. Annika, Steven, no Candace for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
On that photo.
Oh, you know what? Candace was living in Little Rock then. Wow. So I don't think she moved over until like June or July of that year. So she and I were long distance.
But I bring that up also because now is a really good time to join our Slack channel. If you go to the FFWpodcast.com, you can find a link there. And why do I say that? Because this is the best time when people are all breaking down the movie that they just saw. And in fact, so much so that I would say 80% of today's episode is going to be a continuation of the conversation that's happening over there. Plus, Warren has been Photoshopping my face into some interesting places, which I'll keep this spoiler free for a second, but it's his best work yet, an absolute masterpiece. So you're going to want to see that too. I'm sure you saw it, but I can't say what it is
yet. I did.
So anyways, check that out because a large part of this conversation is coming from there, which is really fun.
I also want to say this is also a great time to go to Slack because we do have folks there that I feel like do a good job of curating the things that are showing up on social media that you would want to see without all of the stuff that you don't want to have to see. And so it's been a really nice, as I've spent less time online. And whenever I go to the Slack, it's like people like mostly Greg, who is again, the friends from work, Batman.
Exactly. I love that each individual person now is starting to have a role. Like Lance is kind of becoming our dedicated timeline and detail guy. Greg is like our social media extension for the Slack. And I feel like there's all kinds of people. We need to start giving roles out.
It's just, I'm so grateful for it because I told Greg this the other day. I don't think that there's any way, you know, there are these things that come out that if I didn't see, we wouldn't know to talk about or wouldn't know. I mean, some like the Kevin Feige interview that dropped last week. Normally, I would be like, well, this is why I have to be on Twitter so I can catch that. But I don't because we've got Greg in the Slack shooting us the, and you know, a lot of folks kind of curating the relevant stuff. But yeah, so I the reason I say all that is if you are someone that really enjoys this stuff and these kinds of conversations, but you're not super into the current social media climate, I feel like our Slack is a really nice space for you.
And I hate my background color, so I'm going to change it real quick. If you're watching on YouTube, don't forget you can watch on YouTube, but I hated that. I tried to match my shirt, my friends from work shirt, but it just wasn't working for me. So let's go back to blue. Okay, so today it's going to be fascinating because you and I saw this movie, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, about 2.5 weeks ago, which is a long time ago. Then we both saw it again opening night, which is about a week ago. And this may be the most discussion you and I have had behind the scenes since that day, potentially, on a Marvel film. And it's really getting people going in Slack, which is really, really fun, actually. Again, really healthy discussion. So if you haven't seen Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, I would pause right now. First of all, I'd go see the film. Secondly, I'd go back and I would listen to our 2-hour episode when we just walked out of the film. in Hollywood, California last week, then catch up here. Normally we do one reflection episode, but I was texting you that I have so much I want to chime in on since our initial reactions that we have to do a part one and a part two. So this is going to be part one of the reflection. And I think part two will be the official ranking and maybe even a chance for us to talk to some of the creators in a couple of weeks. Okay. So that's kind of what I want to do, but there was just so much passion welling up inside of me that I had to get this all out.
I do want to say, just before we lose the thread and entirely that we were already trying to lose, can you forcibly lose something?
I don't know.
Just give up. Anyway, my point
is just quitting.
the Slack conversation, you just reminded me. Another thing that I love about the Slack that will kind of dovetail into our Quantumania talk here is what you're saying. There's a lot of disagreement over whether this movie is good or bad and what it's doing well and what it's not doing well. And I love that we can have those conversations respectfully, that it doesn't have to, like, it doesn't have to go straight to, like, this is garbage or this is the best thing I've ever seen. Like, it's a real, I think, desire to figure out where other people are coming from. Like, I think one of the things that I've noticed about the Slack is people actually can change their minds.
Like, that's true.
Like, you will actually see someone come in with one opinion and then have a dialogue and then leave, if not having totally changed their opinion, at least having, you know, altered their perspective somewhat. And I feel like that is also a very rare thing. So if you leave a movie like this that is kind of, you know, is proving to be divisive, which is funny because I think I said in our initial reactions episode I thought it would not be as divisive. I feel like this is a really good place to kind of air some of those questions, concerns, issues, and kind of have a receptive audience.
I am a living, breathing example of someone who can change their mind. Not that I've turned on this movie, but there are a few things I'm going to bring up today that I want to just read from Slack that actually got me thinking. So, okay. So let's get into it. Here's how I want to structure this. I have a couple of high level, 3,000 foot view thoughts. Then I have a couple of specific points I want to address from Slack, all of which I want you to respond to. Then, this is maybe the most excited I've been to do this kind of thing in a while. I want to just really get into the weeds with you about the actual nitty-gritty of what is happening in the MCU. Mm-hmm. Not from a critic level. I'm saying story-wise. I'm going to ask you questions about Kang. I'm going to ask you questions about Kang in the comics. I want to talk about the timelines. I want to talk about all that stuff because I think this is fresh on people's mind. It's on my mind. And I think it'll be helpful in trying to maybe not predict, but give us an indicator of where we're headed. Okay. So that's going to be like a really in the weeds conversation, like really wild. And that's kind of what this movie is forcing us to do. So
right.
I'm going to do it.
Well, and we've also, talking about Kang in the comics, we've recently gotten a chance to speak with two of the writers that have dealt with Kang more recently and I think dealt with it very comprehensively. Mm-hmm. And so we may even be able to get some insight from them thrown into this discussion.
Okay, here is my first overarching thing. This movie has a 47% critic score on Rotten Tomatoes, making it one of, if not the lowest score the Marvel Universe has ever had. Mm-hmm. It has a 85% audience score. That wow. In and of itself is noteworthy. That's got to be the largest disparity between audience and critic score in the MCU. It's got to be.
Do you know what the, like, what other Phase 4 films have had in terms of audience score? Like, have you gotten a chance to put eyes on that? I have no context of if that's standard and it's just the critic score is super low or if that's particularly high for an audience score.
That is not standard at all. Like I said, I would guess it's the largest gap. I'm going to pull it open right now if you're watching. Okay, Eternals is 47 to 77.
Okay.
So that's a large gap. Not quite as large, about 10% less. Love and Thunder, maybe? could be another one.
Yeah, I'd be curious where.
Love and Thunder is 64 critic, crazy, to 77% audience.
Okay, so it's pretty high.
But that gap is, you know, only 13% versus 40%.
No, I mean Ant-Man is pretty high, like to be in the 80s. I mean, both of those in terms of movies that were critically not as well received were what, like 10% lower?
And it is funny. It is funny because you and I did talk at length about how I don't see this being very divisive. I have a hard time seeing people. Now where I'll say I'm right, I think, is that on our Slack, at least, and on social media, there aren't a ton of people that like hated it. Like some people hated Thor, where they like are starting petitions to remove Taika. I don't know that I've seen that as much. It's been more of what I thought, which is kind of like, that wasn't very good. I liked this, but like a lot of this I didn't like.
It's so interesting seeing how these conversations develop too, because there's a psychology that I feel like can cut both ways, and I never know how it will play out after you get either a really well-received movie or a really poorly received movie that people are rooting for on some level. It's like,
oh, sure.
I felt that. Yeah, I mean, because there's a part of me that's like, you know, when you go in and the movie is getting these rave reviews, are your expectations so high that you can't really help but be disappointed? And then on the flip side, when you go in with a movie that has a really low reception or, you know, poor reception, do you then go in with such low expectations that you come out and you're like, I don't know what everyone was talking about. Like that was, you know, in a movie that you maybe would have given like a 60-something percent is now kind of bumped up maybe artificially. And I don't, you know, I feel like I can go on the flip side. I also think sometimes a movie being poorly received, you go in and you're like, this is a bad movie. And then you see everything through that lens. So I just think it's a really, maybe it's person specific or project specific, but I do feel like, and I say that because I feel like I've seen a lot of people say some version of, I don't know what the critics are talking about. It's not perfect, but it was fun.
Totally. That's where Rotten Tomatoes isn't the best, right? Because, again, they're just answering if it's fresh or if it's rotten. They're not actually saying, I give this 50%. They're either clicking like yes or no kind of thing, or at least they're not clicking it, but it's, you know, accumulating all those things. I think I've landed on this. I've thought about this so much, Robbie. This movie and the poor reception from the critics was literally making me lose sleep at night because I didn't want to be that wrong. I've never wanted to be that far off from what critics thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then that obviously just led to like a massive discussion with people about like, is that okay? I think we even view movies differently than we used to. Like there's no world that this movie is worse than Thor Dark World to me, but that has a higher score in Rotten Tomatoes. And I just don't like, that's the kind of thing where it's like something has changed in the last 10 years in how we, you know, maybe what you're saying, the expectations we carry into this and what it needs to be. Here's my point. First overarching thought. I think that this movie needs to be felt more than broken down afterward. And I think that's why someone like me, who is predisposed to letting my emotions get the best of me, can watch it and love it so much and be so stoked on it at first because I wasn't thinking about it. I was feeling it. Mm-hmm. The more I think about it, I totally understand what these critiques people are saying are. And so if you were in the theater and for whatever reason your theater experience was jank or the jokes just, it's not your humor or like the sound was not loud enough to like engulf the theater, whatever it is, if it didn't hit you right in the feel department, then it's not a very good movie because there's not a lot else I think that it's doing super well that you could point at and be like, wow, this is an achievement. There are a few other things I would say, but what do you think about that? And so for the people that it did hit well, they left being like, that was so much fun. Holy cow. Yes. Fresh, 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 fresh.
Yeah. No, I mean, that, I think I said something similar in the Slack after my viewing, my second viewing. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I have never had such a different experience watching a movie from the first to second watch. And what I mean by that is, you know, we record our initial reactions, sort of chronicling our first watch, at the early screener. And then Candace and I got to go to the screener here in Austin that was just a couple days before the release. And I really don't think this was me being influenced by critics, because the whole time up until then, I'd kind of been playing apologist already. Like, the critics, those reviews started coming out. It was becoming clear what the score was going to be, and then it was probably going to be rotten. And even still, like, that day as I was going into the theater, I remember, like, telling Candace, like, I want your honest take on this, because I feel crazy. I loved it. You know, I didn't see it being a movie with issues. And so I went in, I think, in the correct headspace to enjoy it. But whether it was because we had a theater that was just, like, comically, like, not even raucous. It was just a lot of people moving around. There was a mom. And you know what? Like, I get it. And it's like Scott to Hank. Like, damn it, I respect you. she got one of those massive, massive tubs of popcorn.
Okay.
And had also brought in like 8 shoe boxes that she distributed to all the kids that she had brought with her. Cause this was it was a press screening, but it was a special thing where like they gave away some level of like general admission tickets. And so she would periodically, throughout the movie. And it's not a long movie. It's like a 2-hour movie. And she would go and fill up the big tub and then come back and like just like standing up in the aisle, pour the tub into the shoeboxes. So every like, you know, 30, 35 minutes, you would hear the sound of popcorn leaving the tub and into the shoeboxes.
Shout out to all the moms out there.
You know what?
Like, just taking care of those kids.
And it is, Candace and I were unpacking it after, and it's like, you know, movie theater concessions are expensive, man. Inflation's real. I get it. But it was just, there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. But I think you're right. And the reason I felt that way afterwards, you know, in terms of it being a movie you feel not maybe analyze, is I do think in our first viewing, it was so much like, I don't know what's going to come next. I don't know, like, is someone going to die? Yes. How is Kang going to appear? How is Kang going to link up to Loki Kang? It was just so much, so many questions. And then I felt like every scene was just a new thing. Like, I didn't know what direction we were going in. And so I didn't have time to kind of sit back and analyze, even in the way that that I maybe did with, like, Wakanda Forever, which moves at a slightly slower pace and is just dealing with, you know, less craziness. But yeah, I think...
But that's kind of the point, is one of my first premises, but keep going.
Well, yeah, I think for me, one of the major factors was having Candace there with me. It's like what we talk about, like whenever you watch something through someone else's eyes, then you sometimes, like, you start to think about it and think about it going through, like, their filters. And I just kept, I saw things that, like, on our first viewing, I was like, oh, man, this is hilarious. And I like, texted Candace and was like, you're going to love it. And then I was sitting in it with her. And apart from her reaction, because, you know, from seeing movies with me, I don't actually look over at the person I'm watching a movie with because I'm trying to, like, stay locked in. But I was just able to tell, like, oh, wait, this is not going to hit. Like, this, like, she's gonna think that this is silly in a bad way. And as I kept racking up those moments and waiting for it to come back, I was like, oh, wait, okay, I'm seeing, even if I don't, even if I'm not there, like I'm not giving this a 47%, I'm now seeing the movie that critics are seeing. And it was a very weird experience. And all that to say, I think I agree with you. I think the big difference between those two viewings is, one, I was fully immersed in it. I was locked in and I was just interested in what the plot was going to do next. The second time, I was really evaluating it in terms of like how each performance and each section of the script and what we talked about with the directing. And it just, that's how, you know, that's how you're supposed to, I guess, analyze things critically. And so it makes sense to me that that's, you know, why critics landed maybe where they did.
So I had a different second viewing experience. Annika really liked it, and I still really, really liked it. So I did not have this stuff hitting me. I didn't have people pouring popcorn on my lap, you know, throughout the film. But I am now aware of these things that people are talking about, but I've been more wrestling with like, okay, I get that. Why am I still so predisposed to liking it so much and defending it? So I would almost argue like I'd love for you to see it a third time, because I feel like you maybe got two extremes, or like you just got an extremely bad one, and especially with the heightened emotion of Candace being there and maybe not digging it. That's maybe the other opposite. So, okay, a couple of nitty-gritty things here that people are talking about. I want to just go category by category real quickly.
Cool.
Visual talk. Let's start there for a second. So I've read some people saying, oh, the visuals are unbelievable, they're stunning. And then some people being like, oh, it's clearly all blue screen, it's awful, blah, blah, blah. Which is, that's one of the things that raised a red flag for me in general, is like a lot of the critical response that I was reading after we had recorded that initial reactions episode, it wasn't like always a uniform response. Like some people would say, oh, the movie spends so much time pushing the ball forward. And then some people say, oh, the movie's too standalone, too isolated. And that's where I start getting a red flag, where it's like, okay, it's not like everyone is in agreement on this. Some people said, oh, the humor doesn't work. And then some people love the humor. I love the humor. A lot of people did. Obviously with the audience score. Okay. First of all, I want to separate the visual talk. In my opinion, and by the way, everything I'm about to say is not to change your opinion. It's just kind of what I've been thinking about. Okay. Right. If it does change your opinion, fine. Okay. I noticed the blue screen thing the first time and the second watch in the first half of the movie in particular, specifically scenes like when they're training that little like floating stingray to ride, like you can tell that that was a green screen creature, obviously.
Right.
So there are times where it's a little distracting, maybe two or three times it's distracting. I would also separate out that I think once they get to Kang's village at the end and his empire, it looks way better.
Hmm.
That looks even more realistic. So the fight in like the final third in a lot of ways makes up for this visually. The second thing is, I think I'm just less bothered by the green screen in this. And I know that sounds crazy. I'm not trying to just make excuses for it. I think I'm less bothered because, one, it's an entirely fake realm. So like, the whole thing could look like that and I would be able to buy it because it's not a thing that I know, or it's not like in Moon Knight when they're trying to recreate the Alps, but it's fake. That frustrates me. It's like, you could have shot the Alps. You can't shoot the quantum realm. And I think in general, I'm less bothered by it looking like that because that's just the feel of the quantum realm that they have. Now I know it's an excuse, but that's why I think for me, it's not a huge red flag. That's my first thing.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I mean, you know, I don't really get bogged down. And we talked about this and that stuff in anyway, but I mean, I think for this, I think I had a similar response. To me, I think if there's anything that I notice in Marvel movies with a lot of CGI, other than I would say like Infinity War and Endgame and maybe the first Guardians. Sometimes it just feels a little like weightless, you know, like there are certain scenes where it's like, that's the only time it really hits me. Like there are even moments in Ragnarok where I just feel like it's not, there's like a lack of groundedness. And I think that I got that a few times in Quantumania, but again, I wouldn't even say more so than I did in Ragnarok, which is one of my favorite Marvel films. So I think that it's just, and those have a lot in common in that they both are taking place in these kind of colorful alien worlds.
And then the last thing on the visual front, for everyone who wants to criticize the CGI, I think that's totally fair. I'm just pointing out times that I noticed it. However, I think you also then have to weigh in the fact that the imagination part of the visuals was really well done. Like that I haven't changed on. Like the different creatures, the design of those individual characters, right, and sometimes their costume designs. And I mean, even the way the telepath's head would make a sound and light up, right? Like these are all things they had to think of. And so you can say the blue screen thing was annoying, but you got to then also credit like the cantina, how cool that was that they came up with that. And like, so it's two sides of that. Here are some of the plot things, Robbie, that I've read specifically that I want to know. Do these change your mind since the first viewing or not? Okay. Some people get frustrated by Janet and the miscommunication trope, meaning that for the first half of the film, maybe she won't tell Hank or Hope what really went down. And then that miscommunication drives some of the plot. Now, conversely, two pushbacks there have been, one, some people resonate with that because miscommunication is a part of life. Like Janet was ashamed. She was embarrassed. So yeah, she didn't, she didn't communicate, and that maybe put them at a disadvantage, but that was her actual human emotion coming out. And that's what happens. And other people like me would say, even if both those things are true, I'm not sure that Janet not telling them right away ended up changing the plot at all. Like, I don't think they could have gotten to Scott any faster. Maybe the only argument there would be she should have communicated when she was in the real world about what happened so that Cassie didn't have a desire to make a device, or like Hank was properly warned, but she didn't. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that didn't bother me for a couple reasons. One, I think it's important to have in mind that Janet has only been back really for what, like a year and change, or kind of however long since the end of Endgame. And I don't get the sense this takes place super far after Endgame. And so even if you want to get, you know, be generous with kind of her phase four watch and say two, she's still getting acclimated. I mean, she's almost in like Captain America mode at this point. In the way she's now having to kind of bring herself up to speed. Like, her daughter's fully grown. They've got this like closer relationship with Scott's family. Like, there's a lot. Like, I think it's easy to think like, okay, this never came up in the past like 8 years or whatever since Ant-Man and the Wasp. But I think that it's still fairly fresh. And two, I think with that, yeah, I buy it because ultimately, she feels guilty about that. She feels guilty about what she did to kind of unleash Kang, but she also feels guilty about the way that she left and the fact that, in a way, she kind of made Hope and Hank and Scott complicit in what she did in the quantum realm. So I think it's a complicated thing that it makes sense to me she wouldn't, you know, if she didn't think she was in any hurry when they were in San Francisco to get all that out, I'm sure she was going to kind of wait and figure out how to process it, how to talk about this time that was obviously, you know, traumatic. And then once they're in the quantum realm, yeah, I think at that point, it's just, it feels realistic to me. Like you are now like kind of face to face with this issue you created on multiple levels. And I think it's hard for her to figure out how to talk about. And I think it's easier to justify like, oh, we just have to keep moving, you know, like we can't talk about it right now, we can't talk about it, when you don't want to talk about it anyway and you do need to keep moving. So it's like you can, and you know,
plot,
I think the
plus
last,
it didn't end up changing the plot.
Well, and I think the final thing to me is my understanding is she doesn't know that Bill Murray's character is going to sell her out. I mean, she thinks Bill Murray is an ally, and so I think her thought is we just need to get to this guy and then we can kind of like breathe for a second. And she gets there and obviously things don't go that way. And then she has to explain the
And for the record, she avoided answering Hope's questions, you know, for that year and a half you're talking about. I will say, when they actually started sending a signal to the quantum realm, she starts to explain it. She was going to get into it. She says, like, there's something I haven't told you. Then That's they get true. Sucked in. So, like, even then, she was probably going to talk about it right there. She maybe waited too long, but it wasn't, like,
yeah.
a total avoidance there. Three things that I slightly agree with, okay, that do bother me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The Wasp was underutilized, which is a running thing right now on social media. And I think that's mostly true. I love that they gave her two really cool moments where she rescues Scott twice. Like, Scott is the damsel in distress twice.
Right.
And she saves the day, which I love. But the rest of the film, it's not really Ant-Man and the Wasp. It's centering more around her. Sorry, it's centering more around Scott's relationship with Cassie than their relationship together. I think I mainly agree with that, although I like the two moments we got. Thoughts?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know that I've ever gotten. I mean, Ant-Man and the Wasp had a couple of cool Hope moments as well. I mean, like the kitchen fight, her and Luis. Like, but you know, I don't know that. I saw someone say, and I don't want to skip ahead if this is one you're going to bring up. I saw someone note that there were just some limitations in terms of the cool Ant-Man-esque visuals because you were in such a like green screened world where the frame of reference. And I do think that's limiting. Like, you don't have the cool, like, she's running along the edge of a knife or like some of the stuff from the first Ant-Man film. So in that sense, like, actual cool Wasp visuals were maybe lacking. But in terms of like me feeling like, oh, like, heck yeah, I got that more in those two moments in this movie than I ever have in any of the prior movies. And I think that this is going to maybe be a refrain for me as we go through some of these, but this is all colored by me being someone that did not have much of a reaction at all to the prior films. Like, I didn't dislike them. I also love them, you know, so I was just kind of like, they never moved me one way or the other a ton.
Me too. And I think that's why I liked it more the first watch too, because yeah, we weren't holding the first two films as some like, oh, they better not reinvent this because this was so magical. We were kind of like, they're fine. But like, I don't care if they do something different. I'm not offended.
Which is, you know, we were talking on the initial reactions episode about the difference between like this and No Way Home, right? And how, and that really informs my theater experience, because the John Watts movies were, I thought, really, really great, even Far From Home. And so I was, and I felt, you know, like just everything that was going on with this movie, it felt like to me, like there was a lot of pressure. Like I wanted it, it was that Endgame feeling. Like I wanted it to land the plane. And I think for, that's funny, land the fish.
I know these are weird things to get hung up on, but it's land the fish, okay?
I didn't even do that on purpose. But anyway, yeah, I just didn't think that was an issue with the Ant-Man series. Like, I didn't feel like there was any real standard for it to live up to. And that's something that a lot of people would disagree with, because a lot of people really love the first two, or especially the first Ant-Man film.
Okay, so that leads me to the character critiques. And for this, I might put this up on the screen if you're watching on YouTube or on Spotify. This is from Neil, who we really love in our Slack and we trust with his artistic opinions here. I'm going to read this, Robbie. This is a little lengthy, okay? But this is the comment that got me thinking, okay? This is all Neil speaking, not me. The film is about family, right? Especially Scott's love for Cassie. And yet Scott is off on a book tour. Scott is self-obsessed. Scott's daughter is in jail. She's doing quantum experiments and doesn't even know about it. He doesn't even know about it. It's as if the movie is trying to show me that he's not really all about Cassie at all. But it's never made more than a joke. He's just an out-of-touch dad. But this could have been important. Tell him, Cassie. Tell your dad that you hate that he was gone so long and now he's back and he's spending all his time with fans in the bookstore and not with you. I want to see the movie as their journey back together. It would have been so much better if Cassie were taking after her dad in the worst ways. She's in jail for stealing. using the suit she built, etc. Make Scott deal with that. Make Scott own up to the fact that all this seeking of love and attention is an attempt to make up for the shame he feels and the love he's not getting from his daughter. Then he goes on to critique Janet and Hank, which I'll save for Slack. I don't totally agree with that one. And then, speaking of stakes, I thought Hank couldn't use the quantum tech safely anymore. Why not make the journey down to the quantum realm damage him somehow? He knows that he could never grow back to Earth or even use the tech here the way Scott does. He feels useless, powerless, etc. So you could do that storyline. Hope was wasted. She had a couple of cool action moments, but no moments that caused me to invest in her as a person. And listen to this one. Where's the arc when Scott's life was great and everyone was happy to start the film and end the film? We understand something's happened on a cosmic level, but there was no personal arc for anyone. The great MCU projects take us on a journey with the character and we end up somewhere new. Peter is changed by the events of No Way Home. Wanda is changed by the events of WandaVision. Steven and Mark are changed by the events of Moon Knight. They make discoveries about themselves and the world and are transformed by those discoveries. I just don't see any of that happening here.
Yeah, I mean, there's some good points there. I feel like, however you want to go about this, there are a couple things off the bat I would kind of push back on, but I don't know if you want to do this in any particular order.
Well, I thought that was fascinating because I mostly agree with what he's saying, but then I still come back to, but I still felt it in the moment. So I still had fun and really liked it regardless of those things. And then even amongst those things, there are things that I would push back on. Like, for example, I think the movie was trying to focus more on the family unit than individual character arcs. And I think that there are also individual character arcs that are being completed from the previous films, not just in this movie. So like Hank getting some redemption of using the ants again, I think is kind of a cool thing, not a, oh, he didn't come anywhere in this film kind of thing.
Right.
And same with Janet, like the healing she gets by finally opening up with her family and then Hope saying, I'm sorry you had to experience that on your own. I think that's healing for Janet's character. So she is in a different place, I would argue a little bit. And again, with the movie being focused on that family dynamic, that even with Janet making mistakes, Hank and Hope are still there to support her and love her. That's a little bit different than the personal arc. So just in summary, I agree with a lot of what he's saying. It opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I really appreciate his feedback. Then secondly, I still felt it and liked it either way. And then I do have a few pushbacks specifically on each one of those things, but I thought it was interesting.
Oh no, for sure. And again, that's what I appreciate about the folks that hang out in the Slack is you get well thought out responses like this. So, you know, big picture wise to the comment that you made before, you read Neil's, it being called Ant-Man and the Wasp, I think is, I see where you would say, well, it feels like more of an Ant-Man film because of the focus on Scott and Cassie as kind of the emotional center. I think what's interesting though, is it's an Ant-Man and the Wasp film on two levels, you know, like because we do have a lot of the Wasp in terms of Janet's Wasp, right? Like you kind of have two generations that we're seeing here. And I think even to kind of respond to some of the Hank criticism, I felt like they did some of that. You know, like a lot of what Neil is saying they should have done, I think that I got, you know, like maybe they could have made it more of a focal point, like kind of what you and I were talking about certain elements of Wakanda Forever that you almost just had to see two or three times even to really pick up on how much they were focusing on a certain theme. But I, you know, like I did feel like you never see Hank use the actual shrinking tech. Now they got brought into the quantum realm somehow through MODOK / Kang, but we don't really know what that looked like and if it's the same exact technology or if it was some different version, but it's not like they each had like a suit on that they used in the same way that like Hank has always had it be used.
And so you may not like it as a convenient plot device, but they do go out of their way to point out that they are deeper than the normal quantum realm. This is why you couldn't see it, and this is why Hank's maybe alive.
Well, and yeah, which is also when he's talking about like, you know, this isn't how I remembered it, or the comparisons to the prior chip that we talked about in our last episode. But also, like, the reason I bring that up is I think we see Hank as Ant-Man really highlighted here in the connection he has with the ants, and it's the it's made a joke a lot, but it's also kind of a like he's still this he's not just the has-been. Like, he saves the day with this thing that he's, you know, been passionate about and working on, you know, for decades now. So I felt like, to me, it was this, like, we've seen Hank wrestle with being kind of grumpy and useless, and then he gets down here, and I feel like you kind of see him come alive, and he gets this sort of debonair energy to him, and I think, you know, again, that's, for me, it's hard to make criticism of Hank and Janet's role in this one, because it just felt miles beyond what we ever got from them in the prior two. You know, it's like I've never felt inspired by or excited about either of those characters until this film.
This is why I love talking to you, because I had kind of fully bought into what Neil was saying, but I think you're bringing up a good counterpoint. That's what I love about the Slack too, is like that. Yeah. So now I think I agree with you on those two. I think I mostly agree with Neil on the Scott front, like the Cassie and Scott thing. Like if you're going to make that the central core, you probably could have shown us more of that. Now, granted, again, I'm just thinking again, I've watched it twice. I mean, like, Scott is a little bit perturbed about her being in jail, and he keeps being like, are we going to talk about this? And like, so Scott is trying to at least make it a bigger deal, right?
Right.
And I think maybe it's the joke from the family then being like, oh, like, whatever. But even Cassie pushed back and goes like, you're not doing anything. Like, isn't she doing a little bit of that first dinner scene what he's saying she's not doing?
Yeah, and I think that that's, again, I think that there is a lot of merit to what Neil's bringing up. So this isn't me dismissing it. This is just...
I'm going back and forth so many times.
I do think there are elements, though, of them doing what he's asking for. And I guess the thing is, you get most of it in that opening sequence, and then you don't see that play out a ton. Like, once they're in the quantum realm, they're kind of teamed up again. But my thing
push back there. I mean, Scott wants to leave those first rebels alone. And she's the one that's like, no, we have to help them.
Yeah, yeah, true, true. Well, and I kind of appreciate the fact that they're not in the quantum realm running from Kang and also like having a fight about whether Scott's been a good dad. Like, that also feels a little tropey to me, where it's like all of a sudden there are all these things going on and you're going to pick right now to have this like come to Jesus moment with your parent.
That's why I even liked with the suit when he's like, you have a suit too? And then like within 10 seconds, he's like, okay, look, just, you know, shrink, punch, tap, punch.
Right,
and he's like, right away, like, look, we got to move on. Like, now we're here. Like, I understand that this is not ideal, but because we are here, I might as well teach you how to do it real quick.
And I think, you know, I just think Scott does have an arc with Cassie here, because you're right. Like, we start off with him feeling essentially like he's kind of done his part. I mean, and he has that joke where he's like, I saved the world. Like, you're welcome for not all being dust. And I feel like this was sold to us when some leaks came out months ago as Scott being, like, having turned into this terrible self-centered person. And I feel like that's an extreme read of that. It's more like Scott has been kind of down and out for years now, like as long as we've ever known him. It was like he could never get back up on his feet. Like, he was constantly in some kind of trouble. And I think now it's like, yeah, he did save the world. And it was kind of his, like, in some ways, him more than anybody, you know, like he's the one that brought the idea to the Avengers. And I think he's enjoying a moment to just have life go well. And then I think, you know, it creates this interesting push and pull with Cassie, who is having the same instincts that led Scott to prison in the first place, which was like he wanted to kind of fight the man and you know, work on behalf of justice. And that led him to prison because of the type of crime he committed. And now she's getting arrested for, you know, defending peaceful protesters. And so it's the same thing. And he's seeing where that leads, which was ultimately him not being able to be around Cassie. And so he's like, there's even a frustration there, I think, from Scott and the contradiction where Cassie, on the one hand, is wanting him to be this guy that he used to be, that was going and getting caught up in these larger battles, like when she's talking about him going to Germany and fighting with Cap. And at the same time, she's clearly still harboring a little resentment about the fact that he left, which was because of him being caught up in those things. So I feel like I read into this Scott having that, like the frustration with the tension there. And I think Cassie also probably having a frustration with the similar tension and kind of what she's feeling pulled towards, and also the fact that she has missed this time with her dad and wants this version of her dad, whatever that would look like, back. And so I feel like that's the thing that's going back and forth through the whole movie. And the two ways that I'm happy with where it ends is, one, you see both of those characters, I think, kind of figure out what the middle ground is and how to kind of value and cherish like their own relationship, but also be, you know, heroes, quote unquote. And I think Scott, that's what makes that final battle with Kang so meaningful, I think, is you're right. The whole time it's been Cassie being like, no, we have to help, we have to do this. And Scott being like, no, I'm just trying to be with you and take care of you, which is what I've always, you know, kind of been trying to get back to. And then in the end, Cassie goes home and Scott is willing to stay behind to basically protect everything from Kang instead of, one, being with his daughter, and two, kind of being able to have this cushy life as an author and whatever. So, like, I feel like you still see him make that sacrificial step that shows a development from where he was at the beginning to where he is at the end. And then the actual final ending, I just had a totally different read on than most folks, in that
that's what I want to talk about last, the final thing.
Right. So, I mean, do you want to?
Well, okay. So my question to you then, really quickly, before I get into my last critical question, I guess, is because I love what you're saying and I'm agreeing with most of it. I guess when you said this, the second screening did not work nearly as well for you. Why? Like what? So what are your concerns then? Like, what did you feel in that moment?
Well,
because I'm liking your answers to all my critiques, which is true. I'm loving that. But I'm curious what you felt then.
Well, before I get into that, I think we should, because that's a totally different thing.
Okay, you want me to finish my last one first?
Yeah, let's talk about the final ending scene, because I want to get your thoughts there too.
Okay, I want to talk about Kang and how that ties in. These are questions I actually had. On a second viewing, again, when you're not just feeling it and you're thinking about it, mm-hmm. like I did wonder a couple of things. Like, Kang is so smart. He has so much technology. First of all, I thought, like, isn't there a chance he could have developed the same shrinking tech that Pym did eventually? Like, Darren Cross did it. Like, could he have found it in the quantum realm and then shrunk the core himself? Is that ever possible? I'm also wondering, like, and this is where we're going to get into this discussion in a second, and I can't wait, but I love that they build up Kang with all this dread and this hype, and like, he's so unbeatable and there's nothing we can do, but then he gets beaten. And I partially wonder, like, is this the unbeatable Kang? And I understand the different variants and stuff, but at some point I think, and it's not yet, but at some point I'm going to need a version that like can't be beaten like that very easily, which brings me to the ending, which is like, a lot of people have discussed the stakes of the ending. Like, should that final sequence have gone differently? Like, should Kang have beaten Scott or Hank? Like, should one of them have died? Or should Kang have gotten out and Scott and Hope got stuck in the quantum realm? Or should Cassie have not been as easily able to just go back in and pull them back out? I guess where I stand on it is, on the Kang front, I understand wanting some longer impact as far as, like, if he's so unbeatable, show me that more. Like, show me that this entire realm has not been able to overthrow him before and why. I guess the argument there is that you're empowering Scott. On the last thing, couple little things. On the actual practical nature of Cassie pulling them back out, that never bothered me once on either viewing. And here's why for me. I mean, we saw that that's how the device worked. The reason they couldn't get out when they were there was because the device was in the external world. So they couldn't use it. But once they got home, that was the whole reason her and Hank invented that thing. Was to be able to go back in and pull someone out. So for the people that were like, oh, it just happened so fast that they could get out, it did happen fast, and I understand that on the pacing front. But practically, they had set up that that was the whole point of that thing.
Right, which also makes sense to me because you think about Hank and Cassie working on this together, and those are the two people that would be, like, they sort of, in the scene, which I don't mind, play it lightly as like a almost science project thing. But if you think about the motivation, those two people have lost the people closest to them for years to the quantum realm unexpectedly. It's not like in either case that was the plan. So I feel like it makes sense that if that were to ever happen again, especially if they, you know, we don't know the situation with Ghost at this point. But at the end of Ant-Man and the Wasp, the plan was to go into the quantum realm and collect the energy and come back out. And so if they were ever going to do that, then yeah, you know, like I think it makes sense that they would genuinely, that would be like priority one, you know, once Hank's back. And so I had no problem with them being able to create that based on the information they now had after both Ant-Man and the Wasp and Endgame, you know, where you had way more access to the quantum realm than ever before.
Well, what about the stakes then of the ending?
Of like the king, like the final Kang fight?
Well, is that what you're asking when you're asking me for the ending?
I have two thoughts on the ending. On that ending and then the actual like final scene. So that fight with Kang and Scott, man, I said this before. I like that Kang is beatable. Like, I like that he is just a person that, like, I mean, he is crushing Scott. Like, I don't feel like there's any indication in that scene that Scott is, like, going toe-to-toe with him. Like, he has, for the majority of that fight, Scott has failed to really do much of anything against Kang except for that one great punch, which is a nice callback to the first movie. It takes him and Hope working together, which is such an epic Hope moment, I think. But also, what defeats Kang is his own technology. Like, he gets, like, sucked into whatever that is, which I think also leaves open the possibility that he's not necessarily...
dead?
Actually dead. But who knows? But we can talk about that when we get into more Kang's Kang variants. But I just...
Well, and the fight was so dope. The actual beatdown was so cool.
Well, and again, like it's like what we said before, and I just think it's people totally, or I shouldn't say that. I think it misses the point to talk about how powerful Kang is here or how easy it is to beat him, because the point of Kang, it's not that he is himself as each version unbeatable. He's not Thanos. Like, he's not this, like, godlike being. He's a guy that is a genius that's figured out all this tech and has seen so much of history that he sort of has this ability to kind of play God. But when that's stripped away from him, he's just a person. And I like that. And I like the fact that it's the whack-a-mole thing where it's like, even if they do kill him here, the power of that first credit scene is, oh, wow, there are a ton more, and they aren't exiled, and they have access to all their tech. And, you know, we saw how hard it was for them to beat Kang with just a fraction of what he had access to.
What about the critique, then, of just the ending with nobody dying and Kang being stopped and Scott and Hope getting out of the quantum realm, that the whole movie was just, they went into the quantum realm, it was built up that it's a huge deal, and then they just get out and they win.
So I think, I guess this is really like how I feel about that final scene in general. First off, I thought that Hank or Janet would die in this movie when we were going into it. I told you that. I am not, you know, it's funny. In our first rewatch, we talked about Marvel's reluctance to do death. And I I think just coming out of phase four, that particular concern has been addressed. Like, we talked about how we were afraid of certain characters coming back, and that's still an issue, but kind of a different conversation. But I'm just looking at a lot of the big movies, like, off the bat, right? I mean, obviously Wakanda Forever is all about T'Challa's death.
But also his mother dies too, though.
Aunt May in No Way Home. Jane in Love and Thunder. Like, Eternals has several main character deaths. Like, I just...
Vision... almost another death from WandaVision, kind of, right, by saying goodbye there.
Yeah, like, I just think that if you go through, I don't know, I think that has been explored now, and there's a point at which, actually, this is great, because we, you know, Jonathan Hickman, I was listening to an interview, and he's the writer of a lot of great Marvel comics, including Secret Wars. We're reading through all those on Friends from Work Plus right now, if you're interested. But I was listening to an interview with Hickman, and he made this point that in comics, death is the opposite. Like, it's so relied upon sometimes. If, like, you want a big splash or to generate some real interest, like,
it's got to have weight. You got to kill somebody.
Yeah, yeah, you kill. And so if you know, you can Google it and just Google, like, the death of, and, like, a million comic characters are going to auto-populate, because that's the way you sell a ton of comics, is, like, the death of Superman, the death of Captain America, the death of Spider-Man, the death of Wolverine. Like, it's all of these big heavy hitters. And it's, like, he talks about how that's sometimes, you know, really effective, and sometimes you're doing that in place of an actual interesting story. Like, I can't figure out something that will captivate people, so I'm going to go for the always available, but therefore kind of cheapest option. So I kind of appreciated afterwards that they didn't just kind of throw in a Hank or Janet death to give it some more, like, artificial weight. Like, and if anything, and this kind of is, I guess, my final thought on the ending, I liked the way that Peyton Reed, Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania, I think, is both the conclusion of the Ant-Man trilogy and the beginning of the multiverse saga in earnest, or at least a phase five. And I think that ending serves both of those purposes very well, because each of the two prior Ant-Man films, they almost felt like Disney-esque in that you end with everything, like, everything's right, or almost this kind of classic Spielberg, like, Goonies thing, where it's like, we beat the bad guys, like, everything's good. And then, you know, in Ant-Man and the Wasp, well, in the first Ant-Man and the Wasp, you get the credit scene with the dust, and that sort of undoes some of that, but you still have that kind of lingering thing. I guess you could argue the same about the first one, with kind of finding out he's going to go and fight in Germany. That's all what you get here. Oh. It's like you get things wrapped up, sort of.
But I love Scott being like, right? Like, he's done, right? It's over?
That's the genius of it.
I have chills because right now.
I think, like, one thing I was really concerned about is you don't want a trilogy that feels so off-kilter, where, like, with something like this, where you have a new writer come in and sort of a new perspective, it can feel like, yeah, there's the first two Ant-Man movies, and then there's this, like, third kind of random one that is a totally different thing. And it's so close to being that because of how sci-fi so much of it is, and how not, like, kind of slice of life compared to the first two. But I think the beginning and the end are so much that it still roots it in that trilogy and doesn't make it feel like we've totally left all that in order to further the main kind of MCU narrative. So I thought that like the exact scene you're talking about was almost like it was Reed recognizing how they've wound up concluding the prior narratives, whether that mm-hmm. was effective or not, and keeping that through line while also showing that like there's this underlying tension and that's not what it looks like, which I think then kind of plays into this idea of like Scott ending the fight with Kang by being willing to sacrifice kind of mm-hmm. yet again and then coming back and like, can he now, like, can he sit in that, like, can he just rest in the comfort of like having won, or is he now going to kind of be racked with this, like, if not guilt, this sense of responsibility for everything that comes after?
Or dread. So or dread again.
Yeah, like, I think it's just a nice tension, and I prefer it, I think, for an Ant-Man film to the alternative where, you know, this ends like Infinity War style, and it's like, oh my God, and he's, Kang's out, and it's like, that's not these, it's an Ant-Man movie, you know, like, that's not what these movies have been. Don't lose the thread entirely just because this is one that's going to move the story along so much. And so I feel like all of that combined with the fact that Kang is just a different type of villain. I don't have an issue with the stakes, and I also don't have an issue with the way Kang appears here, because again, and this is something that I think we're just going to have to keep talking about, maybe unfortunately, it is not, it's neither fair nor helpful, I think, to compare Infinity War Thanos with Quantumania Kang. We have to compare Quantumania Kang with like Avengers One Thanos.
Or Darren Cross.
But I just mean like, I saw some people noticing, or I saw people noting that, you know, Thanos, there's this like level of like, oh my gosh, like he's unbeatable, like this gravitas around the character, not performance aside, which I think everyone agrees Major's performance here was incredible. But I just, that's not fair, because you had this building in the background forever with Thanos. And I would argue the first couple appearances we have of Thanos are kind of underwhelming on some level. Like if you were to look at them as that, the beauty is they were able to basically use all of those as kind of like false starts and then really do it in Infinity War. And here, I think this is just prologue. We're just getting the first yes. glimpse at Kang. And I think it's really unnerving in certain ways. Like the conversations about like, have I killed you before? Like those hit for me. And I feel like, again, he's not beaten by Scott per se anyway. But even if he were, you know, I think that that also wouldn't take away from the fact that there are infinite versions of him and yada yada. So I just don't feel that particular critique. But I know that I do still need to tell you what I did feel on the second watch. But I didn't know if you can respond to that stuff. I've been talking for a million years.
No, I love it. This is obviously turning into like a marathon now, but a couple things. I think where a red flag goes off in my head from the power levels standpoint is the comment of like, are you the guy with the hammer that I've killed before? Where it's like, okay, this is a Kang that's apparently capable of killing Thor, which we've never seen anyone other than Thanos do. That's where I think that comes from. Cause like then Ant-Man does stop him, or the Wasp does as well. But again, he's in the quantum realm. He doesn't have all his tech. Like maybe circumstances were so vastly different that that's what happened there. But including lines like that specifically does, you know, flag things for me.
I feel like we will wind up having to make this like a 3-part reflection.
Yeah, I know.
we'll have to go more fully into some of the, the comics of all this. But one thing I will say, just by way of background for folks, is like one of the ways that Kang, One of the ways that Kang really utilizes both like the time travel tech that he has and like kind of what his power set, I guess, looks like, is this ability to draw from all these parts of time at any given moment. And so that means like there are certain iterations of Kang where he has this like weapons vault that is basically like, it's Thor's hammer. I mean, which he wouldn't be able to lift, but maybe like,
Cap shield or something?
No. What a Stormbreaker. Jeez.
Wow. Or, I know, wow. Right? You just lost like a couple points there.
But yeah, like Cap shield, like all of this stuff that he can kind of call upon. And then also like all the armies where he can pull like all these different people from different times. And that also gets into like Immortus, which is a whole other thing if we talk about all the versions of Kang. But my point is there are all of these aspects to Kang that we didn't see here and that he didn't have access to because of the exile. Like the whole point of the exile is he would be cut off from all of his power. And all we see him regain here is just the power of the actual suit, which is still a lot. But I think it would still be a mistake to say that that is like, it's not like he's Iron Man. Like that's not the summation of what Kang brings to the table of just like having a really dope suit.
Okay.
You know, so that's why like,
there's I think there's more that goes into it there.
Yeah. My point being like, I think that there's a world where yes, Kang can kill Thor, but it's not because Kang can go toe to toe with Thor. It's because Kang has had the opportunity to pull in basically whatever he needs to kill Thor, whether that's like a certain kind of army or a certain kind of weapon or being able to freeze him in time and just like cut his head off, like okay. Whatever it is, you know, it's not that that's why that doesn't okay. raise any issues for me personally.
Here's what we need to do to prevent this from becoming the longest episode we've ever recorded. I'm going to share one more thought on the stakes. Then I want to briefly hear, okay, if not all those things, what bothers you a little bit about your second watch besides mm-hmm. the environment? Then I'm going to ask you some questions about Kang and the timelines and all that, and we'll wrap it, okay? I'll save any other thing. We'll save the trivia for next week. We'll save, like, other things for later, okay? Because right. I had other stuff too. But this is so good. I love it. On the stakes front, the last thing I want to add is that I was thinking a lot about it and realized that the stakes are not just in hindsight. You also have to evaluate the stakes in the moment. And that's what I come back to with the feel thing. In the moment, the stakes felt very high to me because I did not know what was going to happen. We've talked about that. Like I truly right. didn't know. Yeah, when we get done with the film and you zoom out and now that you know what happened and that mostly stuff got resolved, it's easy to then go, well, nothing really mattered. The stakes didn't matter. But I don't think that's fully fair because like does Top Gun Maverick not matter? Because at the end, everything happens that you want to have happen. No one dies, etc. No, because in the moment, you didn't know the stakes. Like, you didn't know if it was going to get worse. So yeah. I think you can't forget that. I mean, Infinity War kind of lives on that, right? Where it's like, in the moment, it was the worst thing ever. We really, when you zoom out, knew Spider-Man's not gone forever, right? Like, we knew that, like, they're going to reverse some of these deaths, like Vision and Loki. Like, eventually that stuff got changed. But in the moment, it felt like the worst thing ever. And so I think this movie still did handle the stakes well in that moment. I understand the critique of zooming out and saying, okay, not much else happened. But that's, I guess, my final thought, which is like, for me, this is the prologue. This is the kickoff to phase 5. This is not the end. Like, we don't need this to be the end of Scott, of Cassie, of Hank even. Like, it doesn't have to be over here. And it's definitely not the end of Kang. So I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to just tell a fun, good story that's kind of isolated about here's what Kang kind of could look like and here's what could happen. We can isolate it in the quantum realm, which gives us freedom to do some things that we can't do elsewhere. And then in the end, if it's beaten, quote unquote, by Scott, it's not over yet. This is just the kickoff. So the stakes felt real in that I thought anything could happen. But in the end, like, let's reevaluate kind of how they handle this now, 6 years from now, in the same way they did this for so many things, like Civil War, like we talked about, like in the moment felt so real. Mm-hmm. Then they do that post-credit scene. You're like, oh, like, I guess it's not that real because Cap can just write to Tony and they're fixing it. And right. That was kind of weird.
But not even post-credit scene. That's just the ending.
But then we spent 5 years trying. Yeah, you're right. Sorry. We spent 5 years then trying to add stakes, you know, by then finding movies to fill that gap, like Black Widow, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm just saying it's easier to judge in hindsight. And I think you can't forget the role that the actual moment plays. That's my final thought on the ending.
Yeah. I mean, the stakes question is always interesting. Like, you know, and I just talked about that some, but I agree that, like, to me, it is almost more in the moment. Like, there's this thing that always goes around about how, like, nothing that Indiana Jones does in Raiders of the Lost Ark impacts the actual plot. Like, how if you like pulled him out, everything would happen the same way, and therefore the movie's pointless. And that is and it's often seen as such. I'm not being revolutionary here. It's just the dumbest take on like the point of a movie or of any story is not the summation of the changes that were made. Like, it's not like because A changed into B, it was a good story. There are a ton of movies where a lot of things happen where the ending is very different than the beginning and they're not good movies. So I feel like I don't like looking at it from that perspective. I like looking at it in terms of, you know, again, we've talked about, like, I do think this is a very different version of Scott than we see at the beginning, because at the beginning he's very carefree and now he is dealing with, you know, this legitimate kind of dread. And that's the stuff that I feel then. And I think that the way they do that scene, even Candace in the theater leaned over and, you know, when he's kind of like frantically asking himself these questions, and it was like, well, that's relatable. Because it is this sort of like this self-doubt. And it's like whenever you're like, I feel like we've all had that feeling of like, it's like a Sunday afternoon and you're feeling great. And then all of a sudden you like remember something that's due tomorrow morning that.
Oh, I love the actual ending. Oh,
it's just like, I think that like there's a lot of looking at this and looking at Love and Thunder, which again, I think are the two movies that I like a lot that have not been as well received. I am maybe reading this into the movie and maybe that's why I enjoy it more. And maybe that's not fair. But I feel like there's nuance there where it's like the things that Neil is saying he's wanting, I feel like I got, I guess. So that's like it's like I agree 100% with his comment about like they should have done, like this is what would have been good. And that's sort of why I'm like, yeah, and therefore it was good, because I feel like I got a lot of this stuff. And so the stakes were real to me in it. And then also, like we said in the initial reactions episode, I thought it was legitimately thrilling because I just had no idea where any of it was going.
What a perfect ending, by the way, as far as it being a kickoff, right? Like, Scott got what he wanted. His family's happy. We saw that the unit of the family unit is strengthened. Cassie's learned her power, so like she could help maybe in the future. But then there's still this dread of like, I don't think that was it. And then we got a chance to see what Kang is capable of. Mm-hmm. And so now we get a Scott that's not just happy-go-lucky, but also like, crap. Like, he's not able to fully enjoy his daughter's birthday, which is the thing he wanted, you know, for the last 5 years so badly.
Right.
And yet he's still distracted because he knows there's something else going on. I think that's a perfect way to then set up 2-3 more years of movies, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think for me, and we'll rank this next week, I think I had such a spectacular viewing the first time. It would have been top 10. I think as I've had time to sit with it, I think some of these critiques are fair and valid and have, you know, maybe lowered that a little bit in my head as far as like how I can view this movie in the future. I will say when it comes to ranking, For the first time ever, we have not had to rank a film since I now have the critic and preference split, which has actually been very, very nice, because that way I'm able to go, okay, critically, I'll knock this down a little bit because I understand what they're saying. But preference-wise, no one can stop me from putting it higher than that.
True.
And that's where I'm coming at with it. Like, I'm not as high as I was in last week's episode, but I still had so much fun. Think it does a lot of things very well, which we can defend later. To more extent, I have a feeling this might be like Black Widow, where we end up defending it more later. And so that's where I'm at finally. Where are you at finally? How did your second viewing change it then for you? And then do you think a third viewing could fix some of that stuff? Or just tell me about the second viewing then, in closing.
Yeah. One, as an aside, I also, thematically, and we'll get into more of this later, I also like how much of this this movie wrestled with like your responsibility to the people you love and your responsibility to the world in general. Like, I think that that's a, I know Feige said this is a story about family. And I think that that's a story you can really only do effectively with like Ant-Man and really Spider-Man. And we, you know, we saw that done really, really effectively in No Way Home. But I think here also, like, the, you know, Janet being so intent on saving everybody that she's willing to be away from her daughter for 30 years, and Scott being so obsessed with being able to be with his daughter that he's willing initially to kind of, you know, say to hell with everybody else.
And those are real stakes.
Yeah.
Those are real stakes.
I did enjoy that. I think that there will be a lot to kind of keep unpacking here.
Yeah. You know what? We got to be totally transparent here and honest. Robbie and I talked off air. We have to split this up into multiple parts because we have so much more still, which is great, which is fun. Right. I love that a movie is going to, you know, generate four different episodes because they're all getting so long. We can't have this be a 3-hour thing. So I'm so sorry. This is what we're going to do. Robbie's going to give us his final thought. We're going to make next week all about Kang. We're not going to talk critically at all next week. We're not talking about how we viewed this movie or anything. We're just going to talk within the MCU, all those questions we talked about, because off air in between, we were kind of thinking like, holy cow, there's an hour worth of stuff right there. Not to mention, we talked to some creators of Kang in the comics that are perfect for this. So let's do this, Robbie. I'll hear your final thought. Next week is all Kang, all MCU, no critique. And then after that, hopefully we get to talk to a few people from the film. Then we'll finally close that chapter on the other themes that we liked and then ultimately how that plays into our ranking. Is that fair? So that would be like 3 weeks from now.
I love it.
Crazy.
So my second viewing, the stuff that stuck out to me, it goes back to what we were saying about just, you know, being able to feel it versus not. I think a lot of the jokes that I was totally bought in on the first viewing, again, I think it's part of that like immersion or lack thereof thing, but they seemed sillier to me and kind of harder for me to go with, to where it was like the script that I had praised a lot and really loved felt a little bit. I don't want to say like dumbed down. It was just like, there were certain scenes where, again, as I was watching it through the eyes of other people around me, now that I had seen it, I was like, oh, like, okay, I'm seeing for instance, MODOK was a character that I came out of the first one. And I was like, for a lot of reasons, I love all the ways that this was done. I think it's hilarious. I like that they kind of closed the book on Darren, yada, yada. And this is not me now making a 180 on that, but like Candace did not like MODOK. You know, like I know that like we've talked to, you know, friends of ours,
MODOK and Annika loved MODOK.
But I just mean, you know, it's like we were talking to Matt from MCU Direct and he was saying like out on MODOK, you know, like right after his first viewing. And the first time I was like, oh man, like people need to just loosen up a little bit and like have fun with it. And then my second time I was like, okay, like I see how if you are the person that has come to appreciate the slice of life-ness of these movies, and even if you're willing to accept like they're in this quantum realm and they're dealing with this like time-traveling conqueror, this is a step too far. Now,
But some of the lines were still so funny, even still on my second watch.
But I think again, it's just it's that kind of humor, you know, where it's like you. I think they just they
a lot happened today.
Right. I mean, I laughed about like the like at least I get to die in Avenger line. Like a lot of these lines I'm talking about, I laughed at initially, and I think that this is just a larger. Like I was telling Candace as we were walking out, like I one of the more fascinating conversations to me is how differently your state of mind can how much that can impact each viewing of a film. Because like
I think that's so much of it right now, listening to you talk about this.
Well, everything is like I mean, everything from like, did you just eat a meal or are you getting hungry? Like, where's your blood sugar living? Like, did you get sleep last night? Are you thinking about like something at work that you're going to have to do as soon as the movie's over? Are you having a great time because you're out with friends and you just all want to like, you want something goofy? Like all of
again,
that,
again,
you know.
That's The Office, right? I've said that for years. It is so different to watch certain episodes of The Office with all that stuff. Right. Distracted about work and you're hungry and it's on a side screen to your left and quieter versus all the lights are off. You've had 10 of your friends that love the show over. You're all like you all got popcorn and you're watching it. Every joke is funnier.
Right. Right. No. I think that this is just one that I'm realizing now again to kind of go back to where you opened this, like, you need to be in it. And that's why I think more than any other movie in like recent memory, I'm really looking forward to getting a third viewing in just to figure out like, am I just somewhere right in the middle? Am I closer to where we started? Am I closer to where I landed after the second viewing?
The irony too, though, is our first viewing was full of people that were very stuffy nosed to this.
But
some of them laughed too. Like we weren't the only people laughing in there.
No, I mean, that's the thing is I don't, and again, I think there's a temptation to think, oh, I just went in seeing it as bad because of the critics. And I don't think that that's the case because there are so many other movies where I've been pretty comfortable saying, nope, like they just, we're watching different movies. I think that this one was just for whatever reason, it's like I was able to get outside of myself and see, okay, I could see someone thinking this is all just like too wacky. Totally. And, you know, but again, I think for me, like when I step back into my own shoes, I'm like,
You can go on the ride. But how some people can't.
I think it's maybe this is how we can close this episode out. that interview I referenced that Kevin Feige did with Entertainment Weekly, it dropped, I think last Monday, but he has the whole thing is fantastic if you haven't read it, but there's one blurb in particular that I've been thinking about a lot, and he was talking about how they want Marvel Studios to be as long-lasting as Marvel Publishing has been, you know, and Marvel, as we know it, has been around since the early 60s. And he talks about how the way that that's really happened for them is, you know, you over time you realize that certain people are drawn to certain kinds of characters and stories, and other people are drawn to other types of characters and stories, and that also means some people like certain creative styles and some people like others. Like for me, I've noticed that whenever I first got into comics, I liked really kind of straightforward art that just sort of represented what I was supposed to be seeing. And I didn't like it when the art was super like hyper stylized. And now I've kind of like, as I've read a lot more comics, gotten to where the former starts to be sort of boring to me. And I want something to be a little bit weirder and to be trippier and pull me in a different way. And I feel like what Feige was saying is the Infinity Saga was almost like, It was meant to be pretty much widely accessible in every instance. And I think that's why we praised it so much, and that's why we started the podcast. And so I'm not saying that there's any issue with that. But I do think that moving out of that, Marvel Studios has been trying to adopt kind of what Marvel Publishing eventually had to adopt after they left the really easy access point of those early like Spider-Man Fantastic Four issues, which is like now we kind of have to get some lanes going and recognize that like this lane here is for this group of people and this group of people is probably not going to want to travel in that lane. And that's okay because we're going to make another movie that's for those group of people. Like, I think you could argue that, like, there are a certain, like, there's a certain crowd that is going to be super into, like, a Thunderbolts movie. Mm-hmm. It, to the extent that I can kind of lean into more of the ground level, like, political thing, if they can make that feel more like Winter Soldier or something. And then there's another group of people that love, like, the high sci-fi Star Wars stuff that, like, love a movie like this and are maybe in a lot of cases the same folks that would love
Guardians kind of and Ragnarok.
Of,
and-
yeah, yeah, of like Love and Thunder. So my point being, yeah, I think that Marvel still knows what they're doing. You know, like I think that there are going to be some errors and I don't think that means that they're flailing. I think to me, even if you saw this movie and just did not see anything in it for you, I don't think that is a bad sign. I think it's a sign that Marvel is continuing to experiment and push themselves further. Like Feige's kind of final comment on that was that if they didn't do that, like if they didn't adopt an approach where they tried different things and recognized that some folks may be turned off by those, then it would be stagnant and it would eventually just become like such a factory thing, which is what people said about the MCU for so long, that you sort of lose the point of even doing it at all. Like if you're no longer wowing people or shocking people or exciting people by some of the creative decisions that you make, or even angering people, you know, then like maybe you're not really telling any stories worth telling.
I just got edumacated and not in the same way that I thought I was going to be. No, it's so good. And wow. Wow. I can't believe that we are an hour and a half into this and I still have so many thoughts raising in my head. So, and my camera is even quitting on me. I know. So, I know. You know.
Well, next week, I really am. I'm very excited to do it. A Kang deep dive. That is a little teaser of what we have next week. Like we said, we have Kang the Conqueror comics writers, Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly in. That was a ton of fun talking to them. You'll be able to hear some of that next week. And then Kyle and I will also be doing a deep dive into both the comics history and what this movie and just the introduction of Kang in general means for the MCU. So that's next week. And we will see you there next time on Friends from Marvel.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.